Thank you. Be seated.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Well, we got that a little reversed, but I guess it's all right. There's four causes on the oral submission agenda for this morning. In the order in which they'll be presented, they are as follows. Johnson & Johnson Medical versus Martha Sanchez from El Paso County. Hall State Bank versus CJ and Patsy Jones from Liberty County. Morgan Stanley & Company versus Texas Oil from Harris County. And Rosalinda Romero versus the State of Texas from Dallas County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and finish all of these arguments before lunch. The clerk is taping these arguments for the court's convenience, and if you desire to purchase a copy of a tape of one of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Johnson & Johnson versus Sanchez.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Sloan will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, unless the court has any questions about the facts of the case or its procedural posture, I'd like to proceed directly to the legal issues the appeal raises and the application raises. I realize that the court granted the application as the point of error number two, which was the fraud claim brought by the respondent, Martha Sanchez. But before discussing that claim, I wanted to allude briefly to the other ground on appeal, and that was the her claim under former Article 8307C for wrongful discharge. The Court of Appeals reversed the District Court's decision that that claim was untimely only by applying the discovery rule. And I think, as we argued in a letter brief we recently submitted to the Court, we would contend that the Court's recent decision in Computer Associates v. Otley, I think that's how you pronounce it, effectively foreclosed the Court of Appeals' decision. That case holds that the discovery rule is the exception rather than the rule, and that it applies only where two conditions exist. One, where the injury is inherently non-discoverable. And second, where the evidence of the tortious conduct and the injury is objectively verifiable. I think it's clear that neither one of those conditions applies generally to claims for workers' compensation retaliation under former Article 83.
Well, her injury was them being laid off, wasn't it? Was her injury being laid off or injury not being rehired?
Well, I think her injury regards to the termination of her employment, and I would say actually that the notice of her injury occurred no later than when she was placed on layoff. I mean, most people understand when you're not...
When she was placed on layoff, she was just told that kind of stand by, or that she was in line. When was she told that she was fired?
She was told that she was never told that she was fired. She was never discharged.
Well, how was she supposed to know then if she was never told?
She was told in November of 1987 that she was being placed on indefinite medical layoff and that she had recall rights as provided under the labor agreement.
Well, but she understood that term medical layoff, and she took a certificate of her doctor back and said that she's okay. Was it after that that she was laid off?
No, she was laid off at that time, Your Honor, at the same time.
But nobody told her.
Well, I would respectfully submit that actually she was told the time that she was told that she was being laid off.
But is it in the record that she was told at the time that she would not be rehired?
Well,
I missed that.
Well, the letter didn't say that she wouldn't be rehired because that wasn't necessarily true. She had recall rights provided under the labor agreement, which lasted for 12 months. She was told in the letter also that her benefits were ceasing, her wages had already ceased. She received a COBRA notification as required by law, which stated that the reason for the termination of her benefits was termination of employment or part-time employment. I think there are a number of cases holding that when persons are told that they're being placed on layoff, that they understand they're not going to be working anymore. Because by virtue of a labor agreement, things can get a little bit more complex.
Did she have a remedy under that labor agreement?
Yes, she did, Your Honor. She had the right to file a grievance under the grievance and arbitration provision of the union contract. She had 6 months to do that, and she never did that. She never brought in a... She did have a remedy, and she didn't avail herself of it. In any event, petitioner would contend that the computer associate's case controls on the Article 8307C claim. Because the Court of Appeals reversed the decision of the district court only by applying the discovery rule, we submit that the Article 8307C claim is untimely. With respect to the fraud claim, we set out a number of separate and independent grounds, and we believe they require affirmance of the decision of the district court and reversal of the Court of Appeals. I'd like to address three if I have time today, which I think are most fundamental. One, I think fundamentally, Ms. Sanchez's fraud claim is actually sounds only in contract, and thus is barred. Second, that her fraud claim is granted by the Labor Management Relations Act. And third, there simply was no evidence of one or more of the elements of fraud adduced at trial.
Under the contract, could she only be terminated for cause?
No, Your Honor. That is one provision of the contract. There are a number of others. Actually, what happens when a person is placed, an option was, for example, be placed on layoff. The company gave the right, excuse me, that the contract gave the company the right to place persons on layoff for reasons that they saw fit. Under the labor agreement, one who was on layoff for 12 consecutive months or more lost their seniority, which in labor management parlance means that that's the last thing that was the last indicia of employment that you had. Seniority gives you certain rights that extend beyond, I guess, the termination of your employment or your layoff. But when one loses one's seniority, one loses one's employment. And that's how the contract reads. For example, it also says one loses one's seniority, I believe, if one is discharged for cause.
So it's your position that a year after she was placed on layoff, she was terminated?
It's our position that she was terminated in the sense that she lost any right to wages and benefits from the company when she was laid off. That's what a layoff means, just like when somebody at GM is laid off.
The seniority was a
part
of employment.
There are certain rights that extend beyond termination of employment. One thing, if one means termination of employment, you mean I'm not getting paid anymore, I'm not working. Her employment was terminated when she was placed on layoff. That doesn't mean that she didn't have any rights as a union member that extended beyond that day. According to the union contract, she had seniority for 12 more months. She had recall rights for 12 more months.
Are you saying the same thing applies to medical termination?
Yes. It was a layoff. They called it a medical layoff or an economic layoff.
But does medical termination kind of imply that when you get everything straightened out with a doctor and the doctor says you're okay, then you're back on?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. That's sort of saying that you have lifetime recall rights. I mean, it's sort of like saying if you're placed on economic layoff, that you and the company's back on its footing. If that's 20 years from now, then you're going to recall me. I think you have to read the labor contract as a whole, and recall rights expire after 12 months, and that's just what the union and the company negotiate. I don't think the court needs to go any further than its decisions in Jim Walter Holmes v. Reed and Southwestern Bell Telephone Company v. Delaney to conclude that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed, because this is really a tort claim or contract claim, I should say, masquerading as a tort. Those cases, of course, say that the way a claim is pleaded is not controlling. Rather, one must look at the substance of the claim, and particularly the focus on the nature of the injury alleged. And these cases also say that when the injury is the economic loss or the damage to the contract, that the claim sounds only in contract. Here,
and it's your contention that no mental anguish would ever apply in a contract case?
That's correct, Your Honor. And this is something
never applies. Because we have contracts, we have torts. If it's torts, you can get mental anguish. If it's contract, you can't get it.
I would agree with the first proposition that mental anguish damages aren't recoverable for breach of contract. I'm not sure the mental anguish is necessarily recoverable from a tort. But what I think what's clear here is that what Ms. Sanchez is complaining about is a termination for a contractual employment relationship. That's the only evidence of damages, of economic loss that was put before the jury, and that was a question they were asked. What wages and benefits did she lose by virtue of the termination of her employment? Those are classic contract benefit of the bargain damages. I think also it's clear that if one looks at the substance of her claims, she asserted several, the 8307C claim, a breach of contract claim that she didn't appeal, and the fraud claim, And whatever one may call those claims, it's clear that what she's complaining about is the termination of her employment relationship. For one reason or another, she claimed that it was unlawful. And that's simply a breach of contract claim. The Court of Appeals, that ties in really with the Court of Appeals' erroneous conclusion that benefits that bargain damages are recoverable for common law fraud. That is contrary to the longstanding rule in Texas. At least in this Court's ruling in George v. Hess in 1906, the rule has been that for common law fraud, the measure of damages is out-of-pocket loss, not benefit of the bargain. And this Court has never overruled that decision. Now, granted, the Court has said that in connection with certain statutory claims for misrepresentation, statutory claims, the benefit of the bargain damages may be recoverable, but the Court's never overruled George v. Hess or said that that's the measure of damages for common law fraud. In addition, Ms. Sanchez wouldn't be, I wanted to point out also, again, submitted in a letter brief, the Fifth Circuit's recent decision in Camp Ruffin, which agreed. It said, we don't believe that the Texas Supreme Court would overrule its longstanding rule that, notwithstanding the exceptions to the rule, that generally speaking, for common law fraud, benefit of bargain damages are not recoverable. Similarly, under the restatement, I think we explained in our brief, Ms. Sanchez wouldn't be entitled to benefit of the bargain damages. The restatement also takes the position that the measure of damages for fraud is pecuniary loss. Now, the restatement does say that benefit of the bargain damages may be recoverable, but only in limited circumstances, where the individual is induced by the fraud to enter into a commercial transaction with a defendant. That's certainly not what happened here. Ms. Sanchez wasn't induced by any fraud to enter into any sort of transaction with Johnson. The reliance, she said, she undertook based on the alleged misrepresentations of Johnson, was to delay in looking for another job with someone else, to delay in entering into a transaction with someone else. So she wouldn't be entitled to benefit of the bargain damages under the restatement either. As a policy matter as well, I don't think there's any reason for holding or overturning the longstanding rule about out-of-pocket loss being a proper measure of recovery for fraud. Allowing recovery for benefit of bargain for fraud generally would effectively abolish any distinction between tort and contract under Texas law. And moreover, more important, it would put the courts in the business of enforcing gratuitous promises. And not only gratuitous promises, but gratuitous promises made to people who didn't suffer any injury because of the gratuitous promises. That's something that the law simply has never done. Second, we maintain that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed because the claims are preempted, the fraud claims are preempted by Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. According to the United States
Council, I don't understand gratuitous promises. Can you define that for me?
Promises made without consideration, representations made that there would not be an enforceable contract.
And you're saying that she was given a gratuitous promise?
I'm saying, generally speaking, that that giving individuals who are allegedly defrauded or had a misstatement made to them, giving them the opportunity to recover benefit of the bargain damages would make gratuitous promises essentially enforceable. Yes. On the preemption point,
so this was a gratuitous promise.
Well, there are so many alleged misrepresentations, Your Honor. There are six made by three different people. I'm not sure how to characterize which one. I think they were statements of individuals, by and large, the statements of individuals' understanding of what her employment rights were and what Johnson & Johnson policy was. I don't know if that's a gratuitous promise or not. If it's a statement of one's understanding of her rights and the arrangement between the union and Johnson & Johnson. The test for preemption, according to the United States Supreme Court, is whether, in order to resolve the state law claim, one must interpret or analyze a collective bargaining agreement. And I would respectfully, and that includes implied rights under a collective bargaining agreement, or the practices that have grown up between the union and the company under the lieutenant collective bargaining agreement. I respectfully submit to the court that none of these alleged misrepresentations could be determined to be fraudulent without analyzing or interpreting the collective bargaining agreement. The clearest example is the first one, the letter the court was alluding to from Richard Gonzalez, the plant personnel manager, in which he informed Ms. Sanchez, among other things, that she was being placed on indefinite medical layoff and she had recall rights as provided under the labor agreement. That's not all the letter, but that's the alleged misrepresentations. I'd submit that you can't even understand what that statement means, what recall rights under the labor agreement mean, without looking at the labor agreement. And in fact, by alleging that statement is not true, Ms. Sanchez is really alleging nothing else than that Johnson & Johnson breached the collective bargaining agreement because it didn't give her the rights that the law said that she had under the collective bargaining agreement. That claim is clearly preempted. I think that's true as well with the other alleged misrepresentations. Since I'm running a bit short on time, I won't go into those here, but I think I'll have a brief couple of those. I'd like to get, if I could, into the third grounds for reversal, which is the no evidence point. And this ties really into the contorts idea. There are a number of elements of fraud that simply weren't proven. But the clearest one, I think, is that Ms. Sanchez submitted no evidence that she suffered any economic loss that was proximately caused by her reliance on anything that Johnson & Johnson ever said. Everything that she submitted to the jury in terms of evidence and the question that was submitted to them was lost wages and benefits that she lost. Pardon me, I'm out of time.
Any questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Stephen James will present argument for respondent. May it please the court. Steve James from El Paso for Martha Sanchez. I'm going to go right to the preemption, federal preemption issue, because I think that is significant. It has been described as courts as a thicket or as a Gordian knot. In this case, the evidence shows that on November 30th, 1987, Martha Sanchez was secretly terminated by this company. That is Exhibit 16A, which is crucial to the respondent's case. Also, under eliciting by the defense attorneys, Nellie Powell stated that Exhibit 16A meant simply that Martha Sanchez was terminated. Whether it read layoff or not, it meant she was terminated. And so there is no construction of any labor agreement or contract or collective bargaining agreement necessary in order to determine that all of these promises subsequently made to her were false at the time that they were made. Let me further state that the evidence in this case shows, and the exhibits...
James, part of the argument here, and it seems to me it's problematic, what is a layoff?
The testimony of Mr. Gonzalez, the personnel manager, was that this was a policy, the policy that he applied to Martha Sanchez, that he came out with himself to control the headcount, that he never wrote it down anywhere, and when he was specifically
I'm not talking about medical layoff. I'm just asking, what is layoff? Is that a term of art under the labor agreement, or is that just a common knowledge use of layoff? But in this case, when the employees and the businesses get together and they talk about they're having a layoff, what does that mean?
In terms of attempting to collectively bargain,
I don't know. What do the employees at Johnson & Johnson understand by the word layoff?
Well, they place people on layoff when there is a downturn in the work environment.
And that is that something other than they're out of a job?
In that instance, where there is an economic layoff, they have recall rights. The problem with the case is that they have created a separate unwritten system for workers' compensation claimants whose claims go on too long, and they, for them, layoff, unbeknownst to them, means they are terminated. And so layoff has a special secret definition for people like Martha Sanchez. They will never be recalled, no matter how many times they bring in a live duty release.
That's my question. So medical layoff for Johnson & Johnson means something different than layoff?
Yes, it means termination. And that's what the evidence construed in a light favorable to Martha Sanchez shows.
Okay, let's go back to layoff. What does layoff mean?
What does layoff mean other than medical layoff?
Just layoff. What does layoff mean?
The only other type that we've seen in the case is economic layoff, and those people have recall.
Okay. Now, this medical layoff, which is a secret termination,
yes,
in this letter, is subject to recall rights.
The medical layoff? Absolutely not. In fact, the evidence shows that Martha Sanchez was terminated, that she had no indefinite status, that she had no recall rights, and in fact, every other single person in her circumstance, and I say that without qualification, not a single one in her circumstance has ever been returned to that company to work.
So your point is not that medical layoff was a misrepresentation. Your point is that the representation that she had recall rights was a misrepresentation.
That is a misrepresentation, and also the indefinite layoff status is a misrepresentation. It's also in the November 20th letter, which is Exhibit 14. To further stress my point, there is one person who was returned from a medical status out there. Her name is Ms. Pacina, and to demonstrate what is going on in terms of illegality in this case, an illegal scheme to terminate these people, Ms. Pacina went out on medical layoff status because of complications with her pregnancy. She was allowed to return to work. This is in Mr. Breitigan's testimony. But then Ms. Pacina had the unfortunate on-the-job injury. She had a workers' compensation claim. She was placed at the end of a time period. She received one of these letters. She was placed on this indefinite layoff status, and she was never allowed to return to work despite the fact that she brought back in release. That is what they're doing. You cannot collectively bargain for, and the Alice Chalmers versus Luke United States Supreme Court decision says, you cannot collectively bargain for something that is illegal. Now, what they are asserting here is that they have bargained for the right to eliminate long-term workers' compensation claimants. You can't bargain for that. You can't give up state law protections of individual employees by collective bargaining. You cannot collectively bargain for, in my opinion, the right to defraud these employees.
When, if this case goes back to be tried on the workers' comp claim, is the same evidence that supports fraud claim evidence of violation of workers' comp act?
Much of the evidence is going to be similar, Your Honor, and in the Lingle United States Supreme Court decision concerning a workers' compensation retaliation lawsuit, the court there held that even if something is preempted under one guise, the fact that you're going to use the same facts to prove a non-preempted claim will not preclude you from doing so. The Supreme Court there found that the retaliation, I think it was under Illinois workers' compensation law, could still proceed even though it might utilize similar facts to something else that might be preempted. Let me turn very quickly then.
Well, counsel, how did Mrs. Sanchez finally find out that she was laid off and she wasn't going to get to go back to work?
Her testimony, Your Honor, at trial is that she never found out it, and that she was still waiting for them to call her. In fact, I think just by the passing of time, she realized that she was not going to be called back. And in fact, in 1990, she took a job as a housekeeper, a permanent job. Now, your question is, how did she find out? If the court looks at the request for admissions that are answered by Johnson & Johnson and never changed to this day, they deny she's terminated. They state in answers to interrogatories as of May 1st, 1991, she's still on medical layoff. And yet on that same sheet, and it's an exhibit in the exhibits, they state other people have been discharged.
All right, let's get back to Judge Enoch's question about layoff.
Yes.
Now, you use the word medical layoff there. they contend that she's on medical layoff. To what does medical layoff mean to Johnson & Johnson? If they continue to contend that, that evidently has some kind of definition within that company that perhaps is not universal. So when they talk about you're still on medical layoff, what do they mean by that?
Well, their testimony, Your Honor, is that she had to have a full duty release with no restrictions, or she could not be returned to work. Now, that is the unwritten policy of Mr. Gonzalez, and it will never be found anywhere in the labor agreement. In fact, Mr. Greidigan testified that's not the policy of Johnson & Johnson. When I asked him that question during
trial. What's the policy of Johnson & Johnson in regard to medical leave?
All I can come back to, Your Honor, is that the actual policy is that those people are, the facts show, every one of them is a workers' comp claimant long-term, and they are terminated. They don't have a written policy. They have an unwritten, headcount, Mr. Gonzalez-created policy on medical layoff that Mr. Greidigan says is not the policy of Johnson & Johnson, and certainly it has never been collectively bargained for anywhere, and they can't point to any evidence that it was. With the court's permission, I'll move to benefit of the bargain damages. I do believe that the restatement supports benefit of the bargain damages, but also that this court has, in the DTPA circumstance, of course, allowed benefit of the bargain and out-of-pocket damages. But the court recently, in a case entitled Tilton versus McClellan, which is not similar factually, has had quite a bit of discussion in there about damages in a fraud context. And I believe in the dissent, it was discussed there that out-of-pocket benefit of the bargain and consequential and special damages are all proper remedies for fraud. The Fifth Circuit case that criticizes the Sanchez decision relies on Sloan, this court's decision in Sloan, which is a negligent misrepresentation case. If you look at the restatement second of course, in negligent misrepresentation, it specifically excludes benefit of the bargain damages. If you look back at that thing,
I'm a little unclear how they connect, though, here. The lost wages, I take it, are what she would have made with Johnson & Johnson if they kept her in the past. Is that true?
Versus what she did actually make.
And the future damages were what she would have continued to make, again, at Johnson & Johnson if she'd stayed, versus what she's otherwise going to make, I suppose.
As reduced by the jury. The jury did not give us the future damages that we that we sought, and that could be their recognition that she was taking English classes at the time of trial and that she could hope to regain a similar wage level in the future. So they reduced the future damages.
But her claim is that she was misled by statements that Johnson & Johnson made into not seeking another employment.
Into not seeking permanent employment was her testimony. She did, in fact, find two temporary jobs, picking chilies and touching up that.
But aren't the damages that result from that what she would have made if she'd gone out and sought other employment, not what she would have made if she'd stayed on?
I don't believe that that's the Texas law. If you look at, let me give you an example, 8307C cases, where wrongful discharge is a remedy that can result in the recovery of damages.
I'm talking about the fraud case.
But there is no Texas decision holding what Your Honor is stating. And so all I can look to are other similar decisions in wrongful discharge cases.
Well, it's clear in a wrongful discharge case, you're entitled to what you would have gotten if they hadn't fired you, if you'd stayed on. And we've indicated that in prior opinions, but that's not the same as fraud. Fraud, what you're saying is, because you told me I was going to get to stay here, I didn't go take a job that paid 10 times as much, and therefore I should get that money that I forewent because I relied on your promises. But that's not your claim. Your claim is, because I relied on your promises, I didn't go seek other permanent employment, therefore you should pay me what I would have gotten if I'd stayed.
That is also, Your Honor, why I think it's important to note that the court allows, if they have been pled, special or consequential damages for fraud, because fraud is such an onerous tort of culpable state that if you allow me to plead special and consequential damages, if you say this is not strict benefit of the bargain, I believe that we have pled and proved the types of damages that she should be allowed to recover. Obviously, we may be fixing to have an opinion from this court as to whether or not that's correct or not.
Well, it's not a question to me so much special or consequential damages, but just your theory. Your theory is, if they hadn't told me what they had lied to me, I would have gotten a better job. Now, if the defendant can prove that you wouldn't have gotten a better job, looks to me you lose on that theory. You can't turn it around and then say, well, but I would have gotten even more if I'd stayed. That's the problem I'm having. I don't see the connection.
Yeah, I don't understand that there is any testimony in this case that they have proven. We're kind of, to me, it seems like we're dealing in a question of mitigation here, whether or not she has properly mitigated her damages, and that type of evidence that the defense can present. They didn't present any. The undisputed testimony from herself and from her attorney is that she did seek out other jobs, but she sought only temporary jobs. The testimony was that she didn't leave El Paso, as many El Pasoans do, to seek employment elsewhere while she was waiting. The testimony was that she didn't undertake immediately English courses because Johnson & Johnson does not require them to write or speak English.
But the damages that she proved were not damages from foregoing that, I take it.
The back wages certainly were.
The back wages were what she would have made at Johnson & Johnson.
Versus what she made during the temporary time.
And the future wages were what she would have made at Johnson & Johnson if she'd stayed on.
Versus her housekeeping position, discounted back, lessened by the jury for whatever reasons perhaps they thought she would return to employment. I agree with the Court of Appeals in this respect, Your Honor. It's the only thing that I can do is say that this is the type of damage that is appropriate for this type of fraud. Now, she also did prove beyond a doubt mental anguish. So certainly, I believe that fraud as an intentional tort should yield mental anguish damages.
Which is one of the questions that's been raised here.
It certainly is a question that has been raised.
Why should mental anguish damages be allowed for fraud?
Because it's an intentional tort. It is a culpable mental state. This court has allowed it in State Farm versus Beeston, has allowed it in the DTPA circumstances. Those are cases where the standard is knowingly. Knowingly, I think it's the Luna DTPA case out of this court that says intentionally is a higher standard than knowingly. The legislature has now allowed trebling of mental anguish for intentional conduct under the DTPA, trebling of mental anguish damages. I just believe everything in the court's holdings in the past says that for a culpable fraud like this, that mental anguish damages should be recovered. And I've cited Brown versus American Transfer and Storage. These are not exactly on point, but the cases discuss the recovery of mental anguish for intentional torts. And then I have sent to the court recently a letter that just in the last few days that cites a number of other jurisdictions in the employment context where fraud has been committed that they permit mental anguish damages.
Do the wrongful discharge damages overlap with the fraud damages here?
If I am permitted to go back and retry this case under 8307C, I will certainly be asking for the wrongful discharge damages under the same economics report that we have now. So they will be the same damages.
And so is that a double recovery? I mean, if you're allowed to have back wages?
Well, of course, I don't know what the next jury will do, but the trial court would then have to determine whether or not there was a double recovery, and then would have to, if it felt that there was a double recovery, would have to eliminate, make me elect, or elect for me, as I understand it, which theory and the maximum amount of damages that I can recover for my client.
But the measure, the kinds of damages you're trying to prove would be the same on both theories.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think they're, that the 8307C situation gives us an analogous theory for the fraud in an employment context.
While we interrupted you, let me ask you one other question. There are two questions about limitations that seem to arise in this record. One is, when did the termination occur? And the second one is, if it occurred more than the period of time before you should have brought suit, does the discovery rule of fraudulent concealment apply? But I take it your position earlier was that the termination actually occurred on November 20th, 1988.
The secret termination. November 20th, 1987. Actually, the 16A is dated November 30th.
November
30th. The letter, Exhibit 14, is sent out on November 20th, 1987. I'm sorry if I'm confused.
So if that's the date the termination occurred, then you need the discovery rule of fraudulent concealment to apply.
Well,
to save your termination claim.
To save the 8307C claim?
Yes.
Of course, the burden is on them. They've not yet proven when, and that, I think, is the whole point, is that they never met their burden. But yes, I have asserted that.
Never met their burden what? Never met their burden to prove what?
They never proved when she knew or reasonably should have known that these adverse actions had been taken against her.
I understand that. But it is your position the termination occurred on November 30th, 1987, or not?
Secret, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, if I may, I think it's terribly important for me to clear up what I think is a fundamental misunderstanding about the fact of this case, which goes to both the fraud claim and the 8307C claim. I think it's very important for the court in reviewing this case to look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 14, whether or not plaintiffs have represented Exhibit 14, which is the letter that cried Ms. Sanchez that she was being placed on layoff. This is what the letter said. Effective October 10, 1987, you completed 6 months on leave of absence due to the anticipated length of your leave, and you were failed to return to regular full-time work. You have been placed on indefinite medical layoff. Effective the end of November, medical benefits for you and any coverage dependents will terminate. You are eligible to continue medical coverage under your own name through COBRA provision. Close with information providing the coverage as well as an enrollment form. You will have recall rights as provided under the labor agreement and are required to contact me immediately upon your release to return to regular full-time work. At that time, we will discuss any vacancy that exists.
Well, how does that fit in with Ms. Powell's statement that meant termination?
Ms. Powell's statement, which is what I lead to, actually, that's the secret termination. That is Plaintiff's Exhibit 16A. It is a wage personnel change note and internal form of Johnson & Johnson. It says reason for change. There are a number of boxes there or lines there that can be checked. There's not one for layoff. There is one for termination. She's checked that. This is a wage personnel change notice. She's been laid off. She's not going to be getting wages anymore. At the bottom, the secret termination paper says employee has been on leave of absence for 6 months. She had. Due to a duration of leave, employee has been placed on medical layoff, which is what she's been told. Employee has recall rights, as she's been told. The secret termination said exactly what the letter that Mr. Gonzalez said sent to Ms. Sanchez. And by the way, I wanted to mention, with Mr. Gonzalez's letter, was the COBRA notice saying that the reason for her benefit was being terminated was termination for part-time employment. And along with that, he sent a letter saying, in Spanish, if you don't understand this, please call me. She never called him. She didn't know she never called him. And she never asked anybody what her recall rights were provided under the labor agreement, even though she was represented by the union. And as a matter of law, she was on notice of what her recall rights under the collective bargaining agreement were. Notwithstanding that, she claims that it was her understanding she had recall rights, not of 12 months as provided under the union contract,
but forever, or at least until whenever she felt that she was able to return to work.
Is there a difference in your position here in between termination and layoff?
The case would say, Your Honor, it depends on for statute of limitations, our argument would be that what she's complaining about is a loss of her wages and benefits. She was notified that she was placed on layoff. We cited the court to a number of cases from deciding cases under the federal civil rights statutes, employment discrimination statutes, all saying that if you tell somebody on layoff, that's unequivocal notice of your injury, and the limitations period under federal law starts running, and I submit that that rule applies here. Now there are circumstances. For example, the collective bargaining agreement still gave her rights after her layoff. I mean, that's why she was placed on layoff.
But the quote you read used both terms. You used terminated, you had the box terminated check.
Yes.
And then talked about her being laid off. So, what's the difference?
The secret termination was a wage personnel change notice.
What about her testimony that the Court of Appeals quotes that says, Ms. Powell saying, I regard it as a termination of employment, whether it was a layoff or not. It was the termination of employment, period.
Right. And again, it was for the purposes of the form that she was filling out, wage personnel change notice. Again, at the very bottom, what she wrote in, she just checked
the box. Talking about her testimony in court.
Yes, and for the purposes of the wage personnel change notice, and for purposes of COBRA, it was.
And it's also your position for purposes of a wrongful discharge suit.
Yes.
That she had, 2 years to file her claim.
Yes. After she was placed on layoff, I think she was on notice that it was readily apparent that she was not guaranteed reemployment, and if she'd gone to a union representative and looked under the collective bargaining agreement, she would have known that as well. And she didn't have any rights at all 12 months after that. That layoff triggered the running of 12-month recall rights.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.